Welcome to the DBS Films Podcast, a behind-the-scenes look into making indie films. Learn from DBS Films about their process, tips, and fun stories that all come with making multiple movies a reality.
Hey everybody, welcome to DBS Films Podcast. My name is Callum, with me as always is my brother Brennan. Together we make movies with DBS Films. Today we're talking about the end of the writer's strike and the actor's strike. And we're going to go into a two-part episode about what this means for indie films and what this means for creatives in general. As always, be sure to take a look at our Discord channel online. We have our newest film, Horror in the Forest, which is out now. If you give it a rent and review, that means the world to us. But if you want to be part of the movies, go ahead and take a look at our Discord community because that is where our open auditions are taking place. So, great news again. Honestly, this was something where when we were first both talking about this, we kind of were pretty accurate in our prediction. I know I said about October, I think you were right around the same one there too, kind of average the writer's strike and the actor's strike, which, again, it is just ended. We are filming this, or we are recording this on the 10th, so we actually don't know the terms for the Actors Guild just yet, but I have a feeling it's going to be pretty good in the sense that, you know, they held out a little bit longer, so we shall see. But that being said, it was kind of close to our predictions. That being said, I'm actually impressed with what the Writers Guild was able to get. And again, I support our writers. I support our creatives. They definitely deserve way, way more compensation for all of it. But unfortunately, the way that the businesses have been going, how, you know, things have been structured, how the overall economy for these businesses has been, I thought they were in a pretty weak stance in the sense of, you know, what they might get. So I'm actually really, really surprised. Huge shout out and kudos to basically everyone involved in that striking process. Again, they secured a lot of amazing things for everyone else that is now becoming part of the unions. So again, really, really great news to see. And I'm very, very happy to see that. But based on kind of the timeline and everything, what's your, you know, first overall impression of these things coming to an end, Brennan?
Well, I'm happy it's done. I'm happy we don't have to deal with this. There's just a lot of misinformation and miscommunication. I did think that maybe, you know, it would help us out a little bit being an indie studio. And that just, it just seemed like everyone kind of shut down, all writers and all actors, whether union or non-union, they just kind of, you know, shut down in general. So there was no, you know, I can't remember, Paul Rudd was like, now's the time to go to indie film and help indie filmmakers out. Yeah, that never happened. So I'm happy everyone's back. I'm happy that everything is, you know, full steam ahead. I like to see movies. I'm a fan of movies. I don't like to see anyone kind of suffer or be at these angsty like moments in here. So it's good. I think it's good for the film industry as well. So it's good that we're going to be, you know, full steam ahead. I do think that studios and pitch meetings and, you know, the stuff when we went to AFM and we went to Cannes and all this other stuff was slowed down as well. And that is just not good for us. So I think all parties were hurt. I don't think there was a winner in any of this. There's lost revenue. There's lost time. There are lost ideas. So I'm happy everything's back. I think we're, you know, we're ready to go. We're ready to hit 2024 coming in. I'm excited to see, you know, good horror coming out. I'm excited to see good movies coming out. And I'm excited to hopefully be part of producing and making those movies.
Exactly. That is time to get back to work. And I know there's a lot of people, again, that, you know, have been waiting for this. It really is something an entire town. I believe it was about 2 billion, I think, and probably much higher is what the estimated cost of loss in the sense of basically just productivity and GDP for California when it came to the shutdowns here. But, you know, I really kind of want to highlight again, I'm curious if you felt the same way that I felt, where I was really surprised, you know, like the, again, some of the rhetoric coming from like the writers and especially like Fran Drescher when it comes to the screenwriters is there is a lot of very aggressive tones towards one another and things got really, really hostile. And then, you know, the terms of take it or leave it, this is our final offer, we're out there. So, I mean, I honestly, like I would say overall, I'm pretty surprised at what they were able to get. Again, happy they did. Love it. They deserve more. But I really thought this was going to be the case where the businesses put up almost kind of a generational defining moment in the sense of this is what it now means to be a creative, which we've seen, you know, if you look at any other different sources and things like that, every once in a while that happens in the creative industry, where unfortunately a whole ton of people just now have a different life that they're living. So what are kind of your thoughts on, again, them reaching this agreement and You know, based looking at it now, the estimated deal value that the writers were originally seeking were about $430 million a year. The value that was put forward by the studios was an estimated $86 million, and the final deal came in right about $233 million, which again, to me, I feel like the studios had a lot of leverage, but the writers were able to get a lot of really good things, which is great to see. But what are kind of your thoughts on that leverage element? Because I know we talked about it before in the sense that it was an uphill battle for the writers and the unions.
Yeah, I think the writers were in a little bit tougher predicament than the actors, but you know, they came through, they got a deal done. And I still think everyone at the time maybe overblew it a little bit as far as like AI taking the jobs. I remember when they had that huge ChatGPT update in, it was like December, right around Christmas, and everyone was like, this is going to take everybody's jobs. This is going to write, it's going to do everything. I remember playing around with it, and you know, we're here pretty much a year later and it's not writing anything. It'll do small little tasks. It's better at searching and researching things, but it's not going to write you a script. It's not going to write you a book. It's not going to do anything creative. And I think a lot of people, I think they thought that each update was going to get better and better until this thing could essentially replace all writers. And it turns out it can't even replace one writer. It may be able to help you a little bit with plotting or research, but I think the AI hype was really overblown. I think there's good uses for it, but I don't think creative stuff is where it's at. If anything, it's like small stuff like copywriting, which I think is a good thing because I really want creativity to stay with the human. I think it's, you know, it needs to be, the creative process should come from a human. If you start to go through computers to get this stuff done, who are trained to, you know, basically pump out the algorithm that like Netflix and Amazon use, you're going to get the same problem that we're seeing now, which is just the same stuff over and over and over again. That kind of feels hollow. It doesn't have a soul. And, you know, that kind of content is not really what you're looking for if you're a fan of movies.
Exactly that. And it's really interesting to see where they did land on AI. So with that being said, again, we are actually waiting right now. We are recording again on the 10th at about 5 p.m. At 5 p.m. right now, Fran Drescher, I believe, is telling what they want with SAG. So I could probably take a look. Maybe they have it. I don't know. It usually takes them a little bit to kind of get a quick sheet there. But if you are curious about some of the details, take a look. The WGA contract really highlights it very well of what they were asking for, what the offer was, and then where they ended up. So we're just going to kind of hop into some of those things. Really the big one on kind of a lot of the pay is they basically met in the middle, which, I mean, you see this a lot. They were looking for 6 to 5% of all minimums, including residuals. They countered a 4 to 3 to 2 for the 3 years. So basically 6, 5, 5 is what they had. 4, 3, 2 is what they countered. And what did they land on? 5, 4, 3.5. So basically right in the middle there, which again is great. And that's, you know, usually how negotiations take place is you start one side, you start on the other side, and then you meet in the middle. Streaming pay also went up a lot more when it came to just the cost of it that they would get for any kind of features. Also, streaming features are now categorized closer to like cinematic features. So they're ending up getting more on that, essentially pulling it more towards the streaming median, which is there. But the first thing I really want to start talking about is one of the big things that they really did is tried to eliminate a lot of the things like weekly pay and a lot of the things as having a required second step. And basically what was happening a lot in the writers' rooms is you would do a lot of work in getting to a certain point in the script, not knowing if they would bring you on to continue to write or if they would just take that script and bring it off to another writer. So what they now have is, if the screenplay basically gets worked, there is an additional benefit then that is given to that writer. So you basically have a second step where if your material gets used and that ends up happening, and then also weekly pay, they've accelerated the schedule to where it's basically you get money up front, you get money within 9 weeks, and you get money 25% of your delivery. Whereas it used to be, they would only pay you at the end of that week. So at the end of that week, you could be done. Now, the reason I want to highlight these two things and why I think it's really important is I was kind of afraid, and how I'm kind of feeling with everything is that writing was becoming more of a gig than a career. And the way that it becomes a gig is if you just basically pay people per writing, per element. You don't give them any kind of security, and you just kind of take those little things and commoditize writing, which again, I think when you don't have that safety element as a creative, you're not going to create good things. So what are kind of your thoughts on, again, having that shift at least closer from a gig of being a writer to actually having a more solid, and I would even say career. The next one I'll kind of hop into talks about career. This is more or less just knowing, hey, I'm going to get paid at least for 8 weeks on this project versus I might work for 1 week and be done.
Yeah, I think it's important, but I think it's a win also for studios. If you have a writer that's good and you have quality content that's good, you want to keep those people around. I think one of the things that, you know, I struggle with the publishing business is we do have a lot of writers on staff. And, you know, getting the writers up to speed and understanding what needs to be done as far as like our cadence, our rhythm, and the books that we're trying to publish, it takes a long time. And it can take them pretty much a year, 18 months to get onboarded. And the last thing I want to see is them get onboarded and ready to go and really start, you know, creating some quality content, and then they quit or they just go on to another job. It's the same thing with the studios. If you have a really good IP, if you have something that's really working, you know, season two is coming or something along those lines, you want to keep and reward those writers to, you know, be on staff. And I think this is good. I don't think gig economy stuff is good. I think that, you know, it doesn't offer any benefits to the studios other than they can cut their losses quicker. But I think that's up to the studios if you're going to try and create better content. And I really think the next couple of years are going to be a focus on better content rather than the churn and burn that we've seen for the last 4 or 5 years. I think that these companies are going to be more careful with their money, basically, because you just can't just crank out originals with, you know, no talent behind them and just difficult scripts and stuff that, you know, you're kind of force feeding stuff. This is what tanked Netflix's stock price. And I think that, you know, basically Netflix learned from that. But the cool thing with Netflix now, too, is also they're coming back with originals. If you looked at the content that Netflix is pulling up, and I don't know if this is with strikes or not, but they are going back and purchasing movies. So that's also cool. But back to the writers, it's good for them, too. You know, if you're having to worry about paying your rent or where your next paycheck is going to come from, it's going to hinder your creative process. And I would much rather, if somebody hires me, knowing that I have an extended period of time, that I'm going to be in no hurry, that I'm going to get paid for my work extended wise. I think it allows you to focus more and contribute to the product. The more you are involved in the process from start to finish, the more creative you're going to be. And I think it works with, you know, we've seen it on set as well. The people who come in for a couple of days to just do small little jobs are going to be less invested than the actors and the writers who started with us in the beginning. So I do think this is a win for both people. I do think that the best writing that we've ever had was probably the 90s and early 2000s. And what were those? They were paid pretty much salary. They're paid long-term gigs. I think that stuff needs to come back. This kind of gig economy stuff really started, you know, really much pretty before COVID, and then it really exploded in COVID, but I just don't think it worked. And I think I'm happy to see that both sides are realizing that this is not a good solution. They came to a good solution, and I hope they kind of expand upon that, where we start to see, you know, writers get credit for what they deserve, and these deeper, longer series, deeper, longer IPs, you know, basically have the writers have the ability to craft this stuff and make it really good.
Exactly that. I mean, again, the 90s really was a golden age for a lot of things, but if you can sell the rights to scripts because you think you can sell the DVDs for $2 million foreign and domestic, then you get to do some fun concepts. So let's kind of keep going through on the idea of having it to where the, you know, ability to be a writer is more of a career than anything else. And the two items, and this was again something where why I felt the leverage was not really on their side, was their preserving the writer's room and having a minimum duration of employment. So their big one is they wanted a minimum staff of 6 writers, including 4 writers/producers. They wanted to then have pre-green light rooms. They wanted a minimum of 6 with 4 of them, including being writer producers. Then they wanted to have post-green light rooms, that it was 1 writer per episode, 1 additional writer for each 2 episodes. Essentially, they were looking for a writer's room of a minimum of 6, with most likely, like most productions, would be around 10 to 12. They were saying, we want to preserve the writer's room. We don't want exactly what we were just talking about to occur. And then they said we wanted to have a minimum staff guaranteed of at least 10 weeks of work. So those are the two things they wanted. And the reason I was a little bit nervous is the AMPTP came back with rejected our proposals and refused to make a counter. So that is a big negotiation step to have. And what did they get? They got both of them to some degrees. And again, negotiation, but just that hard language of no. And, you know, you have to have this level. And again, I think kind of the business mind of things, when you're telling me I have to have people on staff when I don't even know if they're useful, you know, you can kind of almost see where the argument that they're coming from is. But here's basically how it ended up falling down. They now have a development room of three or more writers, has to have a minimum staff writers of three writer producers. So basically, if you have three writers, you now need to have six writers, including writer producers. So that's kind of the way they got it. There is some concept of a showrunner will have the ability to kind of be their own writer as well too. So they let that option in there. But essentially, if you get the smallest thing of a writer's room, you now have to expand it to a middle side. There's not like you can't have three writers working together. You basically either have one writer who's doing it all, or you end up having a group of the showrunners. That being said, there is a few different details on kind of a few elements of it. Again, take a look at it. But then the other one is they were looking for 10 weeks of consistent work. And what did they get? 10 weeks of consistent work on television and basically premium tier streaming. This one was very impressive to me. Because again, of all the ones where I can see being a business and saying, how can you tell me how many people I need to hire for this or anything like that? That was kind of the one where I thought there might be a bit of a debate about. So what are your thoughts on them being able to get this? And again, extending that career for writers.
You know, once again, it's good. Obviously, when people to work, the 10 weeks is good. You know, I think it's good. It's a good starting point for, you know, what they did. It'll be interesting to see, you know, how it plays out in the next couple of years. I don't know. Did they say how long it's signed for, or when do we have to strike again?
I'm sure. Yeah. Every 3 years is the contract, and it will apply on December 1st. So every show December 1st on for the next 3 years will require essentially 10 weeks of pay and six writers.
Yeah, man, I think it's good. I don't like the fact that, the writer's room disappearing. I think that's the best way to write. I think it's having a whole bunch of people in there, having a whole bunch of creative ideas, and then basically picking the ones and choosing the ones that work. I believe that that is the best process. If I had the option to, you know, if we ever got picked up for a big IP project or a big project and we wanted to allocate as many writers as possible, I'd get as many as I possibly could. I would literally get as many of them. There's no wrong answers. Let's give me any and all ideas and kind of flesh them out. And that's just my process. That's how we kind of do it with the script. We'll just be like, all right, what are all the ideas we want to tackle? And then we kind of figure out which ones we want. And then we just kind of figure out any kind of ways we could do the story. And I think you just do a giant writer's retreat with a whole bunch of writers and you tackle this thing and you get a very good idea of what you're trying to do in week one. And you spend the next 9 weeks basically hammering it out. So I think it's a good thing. I think writer's rooms are, as a collective, are just better than, you know, a single script writer. I think it's always better to have other people look at your work, give you opinions, and give you feedback. We're very feedback based here at DBS. And I think that's good. I think a lot of directors kind of get themselves pigeonholed, and you can tell when it's like, oh, this is a passion project and they didn't listen to anybody else. And then the movie's just not as good. And I think that, you know, feedback and writers' rooms, even if you're a seasoned script writer, are just important for the industry. So I'm happy to see this.
I mean, yeah, we've always talked, if we have a writer's room and you literally improve one line or give us one thing a day, we're going to have an amazing movie. So I definitely agree with that one. So moving on, the next two things, this is a big one too. And again, I'm surprised with all the leverage, but the viewer-based streaming residuals. This is, again, all the streaming services never give their data. They don't know what's good or bad. A lot of the people in the industry were like, you don't want to do this metric because a lot of these movies don't actually do good. You're not going to make enough money. And people were like, well, yeah, but if my movie's really, really good, I want to be part of that success. They wanted to establish that. The AMPTP came back and said, nope, we reject, refuse to make a counter. And what did we get? We got something. Now, I don't know how good this is. This seems, I'm curious to see how the data puts. But basically what it is series and movies that are viewed by 20% or more of domestic subscribers within the first 90 days of release or the first 90 days of a subsequent exhibition year, get a bonus equal to 50% of the residuals. Not quite sure what that breaks down to, but what I'm very curious about is they're now going to give data to confidential people within the WGA, showing them what is done there. Here's my question. Is 20% a lot? I'm not quite sure. What are your thoughts?
Well, if it's 20% of the United States, I mean, I think...
how many movies and shows, like, again, like Stranger Things? Sure. Hunger Games? Or not Hunger Games.
Well, I think 20% is actually, like, I think a good amount of movies hit the 20% mark. Some of these streaming services really crank. The thing is you get a bonus of the residuals. The residuals can be whatever they want. So it's like, that's the thing where you can get crazy accounting in there.
They have it listed. It's like $9,000 for a half hour episode, $16,000 for a 1 hour episode, and $40,000 for a streaming feature over $30 million in budget. So those are pretty good rates. I have to take a look at this one, but I think the big one is it's interesting that the studios are now showing, you know, hey, we'll actually do some viewership one. Because I really feel like what ended up happening, again, with the gig economy is the residual economy died too. You know, I'm never going to give you this. I'm just going to pay you and then be done. I own this.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly think next time around, I think you're going to see AVOD really take off. And AVOD is the way to fix all of this because no one has any skin in the game. Everyone watches your movie, you get the dollar for the person who watched your movie, and then you have the streaming services say to the production company how much you want to allocate to your writers, and that could be 10, 15 cents, and then that just goes straight to the writers. And the production house and Tubi and everyone else splits the rest. But you can give your actors residuals in there. It solves everything. I can't believe this wasn't like a thing that was brought up, just because I think AVOD is still in its infancy, but AVOD will give you the opportunity to give out whatever money you want to give out to people, and it's consistently checked. For each person that watches this, you get this many cents and this many residuals. And that's if I was a producer, to give 5 to 10 cents to the writers, I know that doesn't sound like a lot, but over 20% of the subscribers would be insane amount of money. And then everyone's got skin in the game. And I think that honestly is probably where it's going to happen next. I think you're going to see the rise of AVOD as long as Tubi doesn't do anything stupid, but you're seeing Freevee come back and Amazon come back or Netflix come back with their own AVOD. I think that's just the easy solution, but good for them for getting the residuals. That's good. That's good stuff.
Why don't we just have Brendan in there? You could have sat down and been like, guys, this is how you do it. Start playing some ads. I think that's a great idea, though. And I mean, again, if you really want to get sneaky, you can even just pass it on to the advertiser. Say, hey, this is an ad fee to be on our network. And bam, there you go. It goes right to the writers. So, yeah, really good stuff. That's going to go ahead and wrap up this episode. We're going to hop back in with the big one in the conversation, which was artificial intelligence, how it's going to take over the world and doom creatives. So we'll pick up on that one. And then also, how does this really affect, you know, movies in general? As always, be sure to take a look at our movies online. We make movies for our fans with our fans. So if you want to be part of the action, take a look at our Discord. Take a look at Horror in the Forest. Give it a rent to review. It means the world to us. Till then, have a good one, my friends.